From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's something about those early days in January for Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. It was 41 years ago to the day that the senator was sworn into office for the first time. 42 years ago, he announced he was running against a longtime incumbent, the Democrat Frank Moss, who had been in office at the time for three terms. Hatch's political slogan was a pretty good quip, short and to the point. What do you call a senator who served in office for 18 years? You call him home. Of course, Hatch has had to eat those words each time he ran past Moss's three terms. Four, five, six, seven terms. But now, as you've heard, Hatch is hanging up the gloves, as he put it yesterday. So today in the program, we're talking about Orrin Hatch's decision and his legacy and who could take his place. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, the state's senior senator, ended months of speculation yesterday about whether he would run for an eighth term. It wasn't that long ago, it seemed pretty clear he wouldn't, and all the maneuvering had begun by those interested in replacing him. Hatch, for a time, seemed even resigned to it. There were even questions of whether he was in decline as a prominent figure or a political tactician. But then Orrin Hatch, who had always managed to be in the thick of it, got back into the thick of it with Donald Trump. He played a significant role in the tax overhaul plan and Trump's shrinking of Utah's national monuments. And Hatch became this important ally for the president, and the administration had been trying to convince him to go for that eighth term. And that's what Hatch was talking about in this video released by the senator's office yesterday afternoon.
When the president visited Utah last month, he said I was a fighter. I've always been a fighter. I was an amateur boxer in my youth, and I brought that fighting spirit with me to Washington. But every good fighter knows when to hang up the gloves. And for me, that time is soon approaching. That's why, after much prayer and discussion with family and friends, I've decided to retire at the end of this term.
So today in the program, we're talking about Orrin Hatch's decision to leave politics. We'll also, of course, talk about his legacy. And we have to talk about the future for Hatch's seat. You can join us today if you have questions about the retirement of Orrin Hatch and his legacy. You can join us at 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. I should also point out the other big news of the week, of course, is the death of Thomas S. Monson, president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who died late last night. We're going to be talking about Monson's life and leadership tomorrow on the program. Joining us on today's program is Morgan Lyon-Cotty. She is an associate director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics here at the University of Utah, joining us in the studio. And Morgan Lyon-Cotty, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
David Magleby is joining us today. He's a professor of political science at Brigham Young University, specializes in American government and public policy. He's joining us today from KBYU in Provo. And Professor Magleby, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
And we also have Thomas Burr with us, who is Washington bureau chief for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's joining us from NPR in Washington. And Thomas Burr, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Okay, so I guess I wanted to begin with Tommy Burr. Let me begin with you. Was Orrin Hatch actually serious about running again? Do you think?
You know, it's crazy. Like 2 weeks ago, I sat down with the senator and we were having this discussion and I'm asking him, are you going to run again? And he wasn't sure. And this is the same thing.
Did he mean it? Did he mean it?
He did. And yeah. This is weird because it's seriously, he's hemmed and hawed so much over the last several months. And I've asked him multiple times. I'm not kidding, Doug. I don't know how many times I've asked him. And every time it's yes or no. It depends on his mood of the day. So I think I was actually shocked yesterday when he finally made a decision because I wasn't sure. And I talked to those the people close to him. They weren't sure either until yesterday morning when he made that announcement. People the closest to him were not sure.
Yeah. It's interesting because if you think about had he run and had he won again, which would have been up in the air. He would have been 89 years old when that term ended.
Yeah. Yeah, and think that might have played a factor in some ways. Look, he doesn't want to – he wants to go out on a high note in some ways. And we all have to respect that in some point. Love him or hate him, he's done a lot in his life. And you don't want to be the guy who stays there forever. It's like the end of the Seinfeld episode and you're like, please just end it because it's not any good anymore. He wants to go out on a high note in some ways. And he's done that. And so he passed tax reform. He got the monument shrunk in Utah. Again, love him or hate him, he did that. So in some ways, he's saying, you know what, I'm going to end and I'm going to go away and have this legacy.
David Magleby, what do you think about whether or not he was seriously considering running again? Was this just an idea that he was toying with? It was a pleasant prospect maybe for his ego, but was it an actual prospect, do you think?
Well, I think he was trying to keep his options open. And that's explained in part by what happened to his good friend, Bob Bennett, who was defeated at the convention. And so I think he didn't want that to happen to him should he decide to go. He's been aggressively fundraising, which is a signal that his hat might still be in the ring. And as chair of the Senate Finance Committee and one of 14 members of the conference committee that decided the final framework of the tax bill, he's been raising quite a bit of money in Washington. So there were lots of signals that he was seriously considering running again.
I want to come back to the Bob Bennett, the fate of Bob Bennett back in 2010, because I think it seems to have been some kind of turning point for Orrin Hatch in terms of his political disposition. Well, but let's come back to that. I want to hear from Morgan Lancotti on just the decision itself. Were you surprised at all?
I wasn't too surprised. I know he's been back and forth, and I think it is really interesting. It does seem like there was some seriousness to him weighing another run, but it was also pretty politically expedient. It helped. He doesn't want to be a lame duck. He wanted to get these things through. But the reason I wasn't too surprised was because he had this opportunity to go out on a high note. Yeah. He's at the pinnacle of his power. He's pro tem. He's chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and he's had these huge wins lately. And so he was in the driver's seat, and he was able to end things on his own terms.
What can we say, maybe Thomas Burr, to you this question first, what can we say about his physical and or mental health? I know you hear a lot of skeptics and critics of him calling him a doddering old man. And, you see it in the Salt Lake Tribune's comments lines about being a senile, old, kind of irrelevant figure. But about his physical health, what can we say? Do we know?
One, I never read the comments. I'm always scared about those. Yeah. But secondly, I actually did a story about this last year. And, I have to say, if I'm 83 and in the same physical health as Senator Hatch, I can only be so lucky. The man keeps up a schedule that's pretty crazy. We actually, the Hatch's office gave me a report by the Senate physician showing he's pretty good health for being 83 years old. There have been questions, so I should acknowledge there have been questions about his mental health and whether he's having some moments at this age. And maybe that played a factor. I'm not sure. But the thing is, he really does. I mean, if you realize they sometimes vote at 2-3 in the morning when I'm probably sleeping and they're actually voting still. He keeps that up. But do you want to be that when you're 89 years old? I don't know.
Yeah. I wonder about – but we can't confirm. Certainly there's been no – there's been a lot of speculation about whether his memory may be going. I mean, he is 83 after all. But nothing we can confirm or should really speculate on, I suppose.
Oh, I would never speculate on that. I would say he is for the fact that, I mean, again, we should all be so lucky at that age to be able to answer. I mean, I spent a day with him in September, and the questions he's asked all the time, reporters after reporters asking him different issues all the time, and he's able to hold his own.
Yeah. David Magleby, you've said Orrin Hatch has a different reputation in Washington than he does at home. I'm not sure if that's still true. Explain what you mean by that, and how does Orrin Hatch fit in the sort of Washington establishment?
Well, he went to Washington very much as the outsider, and that has been part of his persona, I think, in Utah ever since. He challenged the establishment in Utah. Remember, in 1976, most of the Republican establishment in Utah was backing Gerald Ford. He supported Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan did not get the nomination. Hatch did get the nomination in a contested primary. But he took on many establishment Republicans at the convention, came in second in 1976. So he's seen himself as not part of the establishment. There's a bit of a chip on his shoulder about not being part of any prominent Salt Lake law firms. He started his own small firm.
Yeah.
And so this fighter mentality extends into politics, and that's the mentality that he took with him to Washington in 77. And he was seen as a kind of scrappy upstart conservative, strong conservative, who especially targeted organized labor. And so he wasn't seen as somebody who would be very conciliatory or cooperative, and that changed. And it changed.
But wait, was he like he was like a Ted Cruz sort of Mike Lee?
He was more like a
figure.
Ted Cruz, yeah. Yes, and was willing to risk disfavor if necessary to pursue a quite conservative agenda within the Senate. He is still very conservative. I don't want to be misunderstood, and always has been. But what he's done that distinguishes his career, I think, from the current upstarts that are somewhat in that early mode of Hatch, is he found a way to work with Democrats on many different pieces of legislation. Perhaps the most prominent one will be decided again in the next month, which is CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, which now covers 9 million kids in America. He did that with Senator Teddy Kennedy. Well, if there's anybody in Utah that comes close to Darth Vader in politics, it's Teddy Kennedy.
Or Hillary Rodham Clinton, who also was supporting that bill as First Lady.
Perhaps. And she was on that bill as well.
Yeah,
you're correct.
Right.
And the president... The president at the time that bill is being negotiated is Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
So, and similarly, he suggested to Bill Clinton that Ruth Bader Ginsburg would have a much better chance getting confirmation through the Judiciary Committee of the Senate than other names Clinton was considering. He is the person who brought us Ruth Bader Ginsburg in a very clear sense, and people agree on that in Washington. I've had very prominent liberal partisans say, you can deal with Hatch. You can work with Hatch. Now, this isn't to say that he gives more ground than he needs to from his point of view, but sure. But he became a legislator who was seen as someone you could work with. And I think that is a part of his legacy in Washington that will endure for a long time.
Do you think relationships like Orrin Hatch's incredibly affectionate relationship with Teddy Kennedy – Is that something that is part of a bygone era now, that kind of relationship across the aisle, actual close personal relationship across the aisle? Is that something that's fairly rare these days in Washington, do you think? David Magleby, you first, and then Tommy Burr, I want to hear you on that too.
Sure.
Well, I think it has become less common, in part because so many senators don't spend the weekends in Washington. They fly home to their districts. Hatch and Bennett both chose to establish homes in Washington and to come home occasionally, but not every weekend. And that helped them foster these kinds of relationships. But no, I've heard comments from senators on both sides of the aisle about very strong friendships. Jeff Flake of Arizona goes on a survivor trip with Heimlich of New Mexico, a Democrat, for example. And there are other examples that are more Hatch Kennedy-like than I think sometimes we acknowledge.
Tommy Burr, what do you think?
You know, I would agree with my good friend David there. You know, it's interesting, and he's absolutely right. You used to be able to, you know, bump into a senator or a congressman in the grocery store here in Washington. They lived here. They actually had their families. The kids played together. And they got to know each other, and they became friends because they had common interests, a soccer game, a baseball game, something like that. And now we pass, you know, in the air in some ways. So we don't really have that. So the era of the Ted Kennedy, Orrin Hatch, working on things because they had a common thing in to work together doesn't really work anymore here in Washington. I don't know that we're going to see something like that again. I hope so, obviously, for the sake of the country. But it's not the same.
I'm really interested to see if we might see some of those relationships with the women in the Senate and Congress, just because we've seen a lot of them really bonding to, or banding together and forming those bonds and having dinners. There was reports of a group of female legislators who have pizza on weekdays, and you can't wear your shoes in the House. And it's those types of things that both Dave and Tommy were talking about, being in the same grocery stores, having dinner together. So I'm interested to see if we might see some of these bipartisan friendships with some of the women back there right now.
Let me play another moment from Senator Hatch's statement from yesterday, because it raises this something that David Magleby, you were talking about, his maybe the attitude that has come from his humble beginnings and how that may have defined his, you know, political ideas or his attitude in some ways. Here's another moment from Senator Hatch yesterday.
As many of you know, I came up during the Great Depression living in a ramshackle house built with recycled lumber from the local scrapyard. My parents gave us everything they had, but in the eyes of the world, we still didn't have much. Only in a nation like ours could someone like me, the scrappy son of a simple carpenter, grow up to become a United States senator. As your senator, I've always sought to fight for those who cannot fight for themselves. And I believe the results speak for themselves.
I can never tell how much of this is just kind of a political speech or how much of it is actually real. Was he, Tommy Burr, and all of you here, an actual scrappy son of a simple carpenter who lived in a ramshackle house built with recycled lumber?
You know, he was, actually. This is something that we have to be fair here. Let's also be clear. He's a millionaire now. He's a lot of money. But he started out, his father was a metal lather. When he went to BYU, then he came back to Pittsburgh where he grew up. He went to law school, and he paid for law school by being a janitor. He and his family lived, as he was talking in the video, they actually lived behind his parents in like a recycled like chicken coop. They took the lumber and they made the chicken coop into a house. His little small family lived there. This is actually true. I mean, as you know, some parts can be exaggerated, but he actually grew up poor.
So David Magleby, so is it in part his ambition? Is that a way of... For him, was that a way of overcoming this humble background in some way?
Oh, I think so. I mean, he's driven, and most politicians are. They wouldn't risk public humiliation and defeat the way politics brings it upon people. Yeah. So, no, I think this was part of his persona. He was scrappy. He didn't let his not being part of the in crowd deter him. In the Senate or in his contest, it's hard to believe that a person who wasn't from Utah, who had held no prior office and only had moved to Utah in 1969, could run for and win a Senate seat in 1976, had no prior office in Utah, had not run for the state legislature. He was an outsider. You know, in the Republican Party, a one-party state like Utah now wasn't so much then. There's a queue 15 people long waiting to run for the U.S. Senate. Yeah. Hatch bumped the line and beat Sherm Lloyd and Jack Carlson, Lloyd at the convention, Carlson in the primary, in what was a stunning turnaround, and then fought hard and held that seat, running in a nationally central race in 1982 against Ted Wilson. Yeah. There were lots of reporters from all over the country because it wasn't clear Hatch would win re-election in 82.
Yeah. I want to come back to that, actually, because I think that's a remarkable – that seemed like another kind of turning point in some ways. And this is when he really becomes part of the Reagan wave, it seems. But I wanted to get back to your point about him coming to Utah in 1969, announces he's running in 76. So he was only really a Utah resident for, I don't know, maybe you'd have to take into account his time at BYU, but about 7 years before he moved to Washington. And you hear from his critics the question of how much of a Utahn he actually is.
Well, and the irony, Doug, is that he may be replaced by another non-Utahn in the U.S. Senate, Mitt Romney.
It's true.
Though Mitt Romney on his Twitter feed yesterday morning, his geotag was Massachusetts, and right now it's Holiday Utah.
Yeah.
Only after that was pointed out, by the way.
Oh, is that right?
he didn't do that just by accident.
What about that, though? I mean, how much – certainly he's a Latter-day Saint, so his connection to Utah is pretty clear in that sense. But what part of him is actually, I mean, he wasn't a Westerner, yet he came to those kind of Western sensibilities, public land and all of those conservative kinds of values. Tom Meeber, what do you say to that part of this question?
Well, isn't everyone a carpetbagger in some point? When Hillary Clinton was a senator from New York, a junior senator, she wasn't from New York, right? When you're Mormon in some ways, you're always from Utah. When we think of Mitt Romney, we think of Utah. I ask anyone here in Washington, they just assume he was born in Utah. In some form, that's just kind of how it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I think it also, this sort of all comes to this idea of his persona as the outsider of he grew up poor, you know, but he was able to come to Utah. He's been able to achieve all these things. But it also speaks to how adaptable he is and how he is truly a remarkable campaigner. He knows how to speak the Utah language. He can really dive into those issues that Utahns really care about. And one thing that I think is really interesting, we keep talking about the stunning 1976 primary win. And one thing he loves to talk about is how, and his words are, that Ronald Reagan pre-primary endorsed him. That Reagan endorsed him before the primary. And with Reagan's popularity, that was a big part of that win.
David Magleby, what about that? How much did he hitch his wagon to Ronald Reagan? He seemed to be part of that, as I said, kind of wave, I guess it could be called.
Oh, it was very much a connection to Reagan, both because of the endorsement, as Morgan indicated, but also because Reagan was not part of the in crowd for Utah Republicans in the 76 election.
Yeah.
And so he was bucking the establishment of the Utah Republican Party in embracing Reagan as early as he did. And I do think that the endorsement from Reagan of him helped in the primary, no question.
I referred earlier in the introduction to Frank Moss, the Democratic incumbent senator, three-term senator, and of course Hatch's now famous campaign slogan, what do you call a senator who served in office for 18 years? You call him home. Was it an upset when he beat Frank Moss, or was that wave beginning to turn against Democrats in 76?
Well, Utah was a state that elected both Democrats and Republicans to position statewide offices like governor and senator well through the Scott Matheson years. So that goes into the 80s. But it's interesting because Moss himself led a charmed life. He got to go to the Senate in 58 because of a contested Republican fight with a third-party candidate, Jay Bracken Lee, and incumbent Senator Arthur Watkins. The big national race for Moss was 70 when Lawrence Burton, a sitting Republican with a potential to be – and very close, by the way, to Gerald Ford – had a real shot at House leadership, perhaps one day could have been Speaker, leaves the House to challenge Moss, and Moss defeats him in that midterm. He also in 1964 defeated BYU President Ernest Wilkinson. So Moss himself was a formidable political figure in Utah. And so therefore, I think going into that 1976 race, it was assumed that Moss would be quite competitive and as the incumbent, the front runner.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to 1982 then, because this seems to have burnished Orrin Hatch's career, that win. How close was it, that race? Ted Wilson, very popular Democrat, former mayor of the city, young, charismatic, seemed to have a good shot if a Democrat would have had a good shot in those early 80s.
Yeah, Ted Wilson was certainly an up-and-comer. He was charismatic. He'd taught. He'd worked in politics. But again, going back to that idea that Hatch is just a truly legitimate campaigner. He knows what he's doing, and he gets incredible teams around him. And I've heard Ted Wilson tell the story that sort of in September, October of the campaign, he needed a break, and he went up to his home. I can't remember if Heber or Midvale or Midway to take a break. And the phone rang that evening, and he answered, and it was that standard, "Hi, I'm Orrin Hatch, and I'm calling to ask for your support." And at that moment, Ted Wilson said, "I knew I was going to lose. I just could not compete with that well-run of a campaign."
That it was about shoe leather. It was about doing the work.
It is, but it's also, I mean, one of the main issues of that time was the original Sagebrush Rebellion, and Hatch was very outspoken about that. He actually sponsored federal legislation in 1979 that didn't go anywhere, but he'd also gotten Ronald Reagan to support that. And 1982, I mean, that's those early Reagan years, and Utah was a big part of that Reagan Revolution and loved President Reagan.
Go ahead, David McElvey. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, Wilson did the best of any of the people who've challenged Hatch. Hatch got 58% of the vote. After that election, he averages 2/3 of the vote in Utah in each of the successive elections after that 82 race.
I want to play a clip. This was in last November. Hatch had this kind of intemperate exchange with Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio. Now, as you'll hear in this moment, you'll hear Brown first. Brown was talking about the fact that the Republican tax overhaul was just basically a giveaway to the rich. And as you'll hear, Orrin Hatch didn't like that.
Spare us the sarcasm move. And the let's satire. Move. And
I'm going to spare it, I'm going to just say to you that I come from the poor people. And I've been here working my whole stinking career. For people who don't have a chance. And I really resent anybody saying that I'm just doing this for the rich. Give me a break. I think you guys overplay that all the time, and it gets old. And frankly, you ought to quit it.
Mr. Chairman, the public believes
it. I'm not through. Okay. I get kind of sick and tired of it. Uh-huh. True, it's a nice political play.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
not true.
With all due respect, I get sick and tired of the richest people
regular
in the
order,
country,
Mr. Chairman.
Getting richer.
Regular order.
And it sort of goes from there. What does this reveal, do you think, Thomas Burr, about Orrin Hatch as a fighter?
I haven't seen Hatch so mad in a very long time. I'm just glad I was not on the other end of that one. I was last week, for the record. But you know, Hatch is doesn't put up with that, and he was pretty ticked off when that happened. It also shows that you know Hatch at his age doesn't want to deal with it. He's like, you know what? You call me out, I'm going to call you back out.
How does he deal, though, with the actual part of the you know, the actual kind of meat of the question of whether or not this tax haul actually did anything for the so-called working class, the poor people.
Yeah,
and you can go down a litany of Republican proposals that could be called into question on that score.
Sure, and I'm not going to, you know, defend or you know, promote the senator, but you know, his point would be this will trickle down and help people. That everyone's getting a tax cut across the board, and when you give businesses a tax cut, he says, therefore they're going to hire more people. You'll see raises, you'll see bonuses. This is a coup de grace for him. Like this is something that the senator has been working on for a generation, almost, we'll say. He's been working on this since, you know, the 1986 was the last time we did a tax reform, and he's been working on it ever since to try to do something like this. And he again, love him or hate him, he got it across the finish line.
It's Thomas Burr. He's Washington bureau chief for the Salt Lake Tribune, joining us from NPR in Washington. We have with us in studio Morgan Lyon Cotty, associate director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics here at the University of Utah. And joining us from KBYU in Provo is David Magelby. He's a professor of political science at BYU, specializes in American government and public policy. We need to take a break. We're late. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Two big stories to cover in the next few days. As most of you have heard by now, LDS Church President Thomas S. Monson died late last night. So tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about his life and legacy and what comes next for Mormonism. Today in the program, though, we're discussing the legacy of another prominent Utah, Orrin Hatch, who, of course, just announced his retirement after 41 years in the Senate. Joining us is David Magelby, who teaches political science at Brigham Young University. We have Thomas Burr, who reports from Washington, D.C. for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's the Washington bureau chief for the paper. And Morgan Lyon Cotty is with us here in the studio, an associate director of the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics. David Magelby, I want to come around to 2010, because there's some sense that Orrin Hatch was willing to compromise, willing to give and take. But in 2010, you've talked about you mentioned earlier Bob Bennett, Senator Bob Bennett, losing at convention. And you've said this was kind of a wake-up call for Orrin Hatch. And I'm wondering, did it make him take a turn rightward politically?
Absolutely. And it was a wake-up call for all of the establishment Republicans. The whole movement about changing the nomination process grows out of that contested convention, which left lasting wounds among many Republicans. But I think for Hatch, it was a moment of resolution that he wasn't going to let that happen to him. And therefore, he became quite active in a delegate mobilization strategy. I think he moved to the right. He wanted to preempt the Tea Party Republicans from doing to him what had been done by national groups to Bennett. And I think he succeeded. It's interesting, Doug, because the major issue that was thrown against Bennett, TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, that came about in 08 because of the recession and the crisis, and it was a crisis, Bennett and Hatch both voted for it. And it was seen by the very conservative wing of the Republican Party as therefore a serious breach, a breach big enough to remove them from running for office. And I, interestingly enough, Hatch navigated that. He voted for it just like Bennett had. He navigated it by later saying he'd had doubts about his vote. And it didn't seem to stick with him in the same way that it damaged Bob Bennett.
Why? Why didn't it stick?
As Morgan said, I think Morgan caught it exactly. He's a very deft politician. He knows how to sort of pivot and turn an issue. He does that successfully. He relates to his audience well. In that 82 race, a prominent political scientist, Richard Fenno from Rochester, who studied congressmen and senators, wrote a book called Home Style, how people from Washington represent themselves or interact with voters and how it's different from what they do in Washington. And I remember coming out of my office on campus at BYU and in a small Q&A with Hatch and students, there is sitting Richard Fenno. I mean, I had no idea he was even coming to Utah. He was here because he had a keen interest in Hatch and how Hatch would relate in Utah as compared to what he was doing in Washington leading up to 82. For Fenno, Hatch was one of the three or four most important senators up for election in 82 on that dimension. How did he relate to his voters? And his scorecard, 66% over time, says he found a way to do that over and over again despite changing issue agendas.
I think one thing also is that Hatch had a little more time to recover than Bob Bennett. I mean, there was the TARP vote and that convention, I think, even that election nationwide in 2010 caught a lot of Republicans and Democrats off guard. And even now when we're talking about which Republican or Democratic senators might switch sides and vote a certain way, you'll often hear commentators say, well, they've got an election this year. They're not going to do that to their voters. You might hear them say they'll have 4 years. They can explain it to voters. So I think that's a part of it. But also, again, going back to the adaptability, Hatch has been in office for 41 years. Democratic, Republican majorities and administrations, and he knows how to work within these. And then also he has, as with what David McElby was saying with Richard Fenno's idea of home style, he knows how to communicate that to voters.
I wanted to ask you all about, I've heard, this was a few years ago, someone mentioned to me that take aside the really high profile ideological political issues, and when you measure Orrin Hatch's constituency services and just his effectiveness as and his response to Utahns, to voters, that he's pretty great at that. Does anyone have anything to say about that part of it? I mean, we talk about this high-profile stuff, but then there's the just getting stuff done for the folks back home.
One of the things we do at the Hinckley Institute is we run these internship programs, and it's amazing to see these opportunities students get, but it's also amazing to see what they do in these offices. And so a lot of our students, in fact, we did some research, and over the last 50 years, 5% of all Hinckley interns have worked for Senator Hatch. And they've done things like helped with the constituent mail. They respond to these mail, to these letters that people send, and then they're also answering calls and dealing, especially locally, it's often immigration issues or other things that are happening. And you can see this whole big machine that Hatch has built to communicate with and to be able to help his constituents.
Doug, if I can add, Morgan makes a great point there. this is the thing. If Orrin Hatch picks up the phone, and this is something, you know, again, love him or hate him, with Orrin Hatch gone, Utah's going to miss this. Because if Orrin Hatch picks up the phone and calls the Secretary of the Health and Human Services, they pick up the phone.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that the senator has for him, and we in Utah will probably miss, is that he gets things done because he has that clout.
It's funny,
and there's one example, Doug, from yesterday. David Axelrod posted a comment on Hatch and mentioned that during the time when the Affordable Care Act was being developed in the Senate and the House, Axelrod was being heavily criticized in the media. And Axelrod says he's got on a plane and his phone rings and it's Orrin Hatch. He answers it. He thought, why is Hatch calling me? And he said, don't let the bad guys get you down. Hatch didn't use the word bad guys. He used a non-Utah word for that. But it shows you that he had a political instinct that crossed the aisles. And here it is on the day that Hatch announces his forthcoming retirement. David Axelrod, Obama's chief of staff, his chief strategist for the reelection, comments on Hatch. But then he adds a note that speaks to the relationships Hatch built with individual people that matter. Axelrod's child has epilepsy. And Axelrod's wife is heading up a foundation to try and increase funding for research in epilepsy. And Hatch went to work to try and help secure additional funding for that, which Axelrod acknowledges he very much appreciates. So it's that talent to relate to people in a very personal way that leads to enduring support.
I should also mention we had a call from a woman in Riverton, Maddie, who mentioned that her grandfather was a political refugee from Iran and that the senator had helped their family get him out before the war. The family was really, really grateful. Okay, let me shift gears a bit. Last month, the Salt Lake Tribune named Senator Hatch Utah's Person of the Year. But, of course, in an editorial, I'm not sure who wrote it, and I'm not sure.
It wasn't me.
I was going to say, Thomas Burr, I'm not going to have you speak for the editorial page. We're going to hear from George Pyle here in just a moment, but the paper made it clear it wasn't exactly an honor. It said it was because Hatch had the biggest impact, of course, for all the reasons we've talked about, the National Monument reduction, the tax bill. And they basically called on the senator to retire. Let me read a bit from the editorial because it was pretty straightforward. It said the selection of Orrin Hatch as the Utahn of the Year has everything to do with his part in those things, as I mentioned, but also, and I'll quote here, his utter lack of integrity that rises from his unquenchable thirst for power. So there is that part of this that we do have to talk a little bit about. And KUER's Julia Ritchie had a conversation with George Pyle about this. And he was, as you can imagine, quite critical. I want to play just a moment here from George Pyle so we can talk about this part of the story.
And I know that the founders would be aghast at how partisanship has replaced institutional loyalty. The Republicans in Congress aren't defending Congress. They're not defending congressional power. They're not defending Article I powers. They're bowing and scraping to the president because they think their active base in the right-wing media wants them to do that. And again, with Senator Corker and Senator Flake, when they decide they can't do that, they leave. You would have thought that Senator Hatch and all his pronouncements about being powerful and longstanding and respected would not feel the need to bow and scrape before any president, much less somebody who's barely reaching 30% in the polls and really isn't even that popular in a heavily Republican state like Utah. You would think he would stand up for the prerogatives of the Senate. And for him to say, he said the other day, you know, he's the best president I've served under. I'm sorry, senators do not serve under presidents. FBI directors and generals and cabinet secretaries serve under presidents. Senators do not serve under presidents. They serve the Senate. They serve the people. And I was actually rather aghast to hear him say that. I don't think Jenny Wilson would say that. I don't think Mitt Romney would say that. And to hear him say that is really disappointing.
So to this idea that yes, he may have good constituent services, but he's a, you know, craven power monger, unwilling to compromise, too willing to just go with the party line. David Magleby, just a response to that, if you would.
Well, I think the Tribune editorial was factual in part when it talked about some of the substantive disagreements it had with Hatch, but I think it overstated by a long shot this critique about integrity. I think, you know, members of Congress, senators in a position like Hatch would have tried to represent their constituents on an issue like Bear's Ears. I don't think that's a lack of integrity. On the tax cut, I don't think that's a lack of integrity. This cut in the corporate tax rate has been a longstanding issue, more for Republicans than Democrats, but it's actually been a bipartisan issue. One can quibble about the extent to which that tax bill was balanced. I don't think it was balanced enough, for example. But that's really politics. And so the other thing I would say is this is Hatch's being aggressive on issues like this is not new. He was very much a focal point in the Clarence Thomas confirmation. There was a lot of criticism of him for his role in that confirmation. Yeah. He is a Republican U.S. senator. He is a conservative. That doesn't mean he lacks integrity.
And we see this on both sides. You know, people talked about the imperial presidency. Whether or not how you view that might be dependent on who is in power. Republicans said that about Obama, and Democrats are probably saying that about Hatch. And so when we're talking about how he's working with the president, and I think we have to be careful also when we're saying he's working under the president is also seen as the head of Hatch's party. So we have to be careful about that wording as well. But you work with your party and you try to get, as Professor Magleby just said, they're trying to get things done. And I don't think anyone in D.C., though people might view it, they're not doing things with evil intent. Everybody thinks they're doing the right thing and they're working really hard at it.
Thomas Burr, I'm going to leave you out of that one.
I have evil intent all the time.
You mentioned the Judiciary Committee, and of course he played a prominent role, Orrin Hatch did, in the committee for a time, played a controversial role in the confirmation of Clarence Thomas, tried to undermine the testimony, and some say the reputation of Anita Hill. We should point that out. David Magleby, I want to hear you on the Judiciary. I mean, you've said his most lasting impact, Orrin Hatch's, might be judges.
Oh, I think it will be. They have lifetime tenure. He was quickly appointed to the Judiciary Committee. It's unusual for a state to have two on that committee, as we now do with both Lee and Hatch on that committee. But he became a leader within that committee in part because of his hard work and sort of conscientious conservative positions and consistent conservative positions. And so there's a role he played in the Bork hearings. In the Ginsburg that followed Bork and then quickly withdrew. And he was himself being very much talked about in Washington as a possible third pick for Reagan at that end of the Reagan years. And Democrats in the Senate still point to that year when they're irritated about what happened to Garland in the last year of the Obama administration. Yeah. Reagan got the third pick through. It was Justice Kennedy. But the lasting impact will not only be what happened with the Supreme Court and his role in some of those appointments, especially Ginsburg, as I mentioned, but it'll be what he did in terms of the Utah judiciary. There were several judges at the U.S. District Court and at the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals where he played a very prominent role in getting people that he knew and thought highly of confirmed. And it wasn't always ideologically consistent. So, for example, Robert Shelby, the U.S. District Court judge in Utah who ruled on the same-sex marriage question, was appointed to the 10th Circuit. And we don't know all the machinations about that, whether that was a bargain with Obama and Shelby got but then Hatch got. That's the way it works in this game. But he's a player, was a player, and I think one of the reasons that he found it very hard not to run again is he cares a lot about the judiciary. His legal training matters to him. He knows he played a role in the Supreme Court in these earlier years, and he would like to continue to play that role. Mm. He cares about who's going to go on the Supreme Court. It'll be hard for him to give that up.
We need
Doug,
to get,
if I can,
yeah,
just
please,
add.
Please, yes.
I have to say, there's not a sitting justice on the Supreme Court that Orrin Hatch didn't have a part in playing. He really did. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, again, was his suggestion to Clinton to nominate. All these justices came through Orrin Hatch in some ways. And I've been kind of waiting all show to say this, but Orrin Hatch has been a sitting senator longer than I've been alive. it's very true. And I pointed that out to him one time. He didn't think that was as funny as I did. But it is one of those things where he's made such an impact. He is the longest-serving Republican senator ever. People bring up Strom Thurmond on occasion, yes, but Strom Thurmond was a Democrat earlier in life, so he didn't actually
– And a Dixiecrat for a hot minute.
Yeah.
You're right, Morgan. Yeah. So the longest-serving Republican senator in U.S. history.
We need to take a break and shift gears to now the prospects for who's going to replace Orrin Hatch. I do want to mention, though, David Magleby, Reagan went with Anthony Kennedy, as you mentioned, who hasn't exactly been a reliable conservative, an important swing vote on same-sex marriage, for example, which is kind of interesting.
Well, that's right. And I think Hatch was probably advising Reagan. Tommy wouldn't maybe know this better, but they needed to get somebody that they could get confirmed. The clock was ticking, and they'd made a mistake with Ginsburg as the second pick after Bork because of the marijuana thing, which had not been apparently fully disclosed to the White House. So that's one reason I think they went with the more moderate pick to be confident they could try and get it through.
No, you're exactly right.
That's Thomas Burr with the Salt Lake Tribune, reporting from Washington, D.C. He's their bureau chief in Washington. Morgan Lyon-Cotty is with us, associate director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. And David Magleby is with us, professor of political science at Brigham Young University. He's joining us from KBYU in Provo. We'll take another quick break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about Utah Senator Orrin Hatch's decision to leave politics, which he announced yesterday. We've been talking about his legacy, and we're going to shift now to the future of Hatch's seat. I've seen it reported, Tommy Burr, that Mitt Romney had conceded to friends he thought that Hatch was actually going to run again.
Didn't we all?
Yeah. Yeah. So was he? I guess he was surprised, Mitt Romney.
Apparently, from what I've talked to the Romney orbit, the circle around Romney, and I think Romney was surprised because last time he talked to Orrin Hatch, Hatch was going to run again. So this is all taken us kind of by surprise. And Romney now is circling with friends and family and saying, what should I do? Yesterday, talked to someone close to Romney who said, you know what, he's probably going to announce in the next couple weeks. And, you know, all intents and purposes, he's going to run.
So you think he'll do it?
There's a couple things, pro and con. You know, Romney wants to speak out about Trump. He feels that, you know, this is the country's heading the wrong direction with this president. He was very clear during the primaries. He was not a Trump guy. And what a better spot to be in than a, you know, senator to actually be able to speak out about that. On the con side, you know, he's 70 years old. He lives in Utah. He's got a family and a nice house and horses. And why leave that to go have a Senate schedule?
Why, indeed. David Magleby, some have said this might be a platform somehow for another run for president to shake up the, to maybe solve that question about the struggle for the soul of the Republican Party. What do you think?
Well, I think Tommy has it exactly right. I think to speculate about it when Hatch wasn't sure was one thing. Now that reality sets in, and Tommy was exactly right about how demanding that Senate schedule is. The rules of the Senate mean that it's a very unpredictable schedule, and it goes on and on. And so that would be a huge lifestyle change for Romney. Romney is used to being an executive, a decision maker. And so this would be a big change for him. On the other hand, I think he's kind of chafing at the bit to be able to have more influence over what are some really big issues and what could be some even bigger issues in the next year or two or three. And while I don't know that this means that he's going to run for the president again if he goes for the Senate from Utah, I think it's probably unlikely that he runs for president again. Mm-hmm. I think he would have much more influence over the direction of the party should he run. Now, there's some fun national politics here because I think there's one person who very much doesn't want him to run, and it's a guy named Bannon.
Yep.
And what will and people who are Bannonites, if you will, in Utah, are they going to object to Romney? Will they try and mount a counter campaign? And what does that mean for Romney once he gets to the Senate? Will there be any deals cut between McConnell and Romney about committee assignments or an enhanced role? There's been some speculation about that in the national media. I have no idea if it's happened.
We have to say, at least raise the prospect of a Democrat winning in that race. Morgan, you want to – I mean, I think most realists would say that that's probably not likely, but we should at least say something about that.
I think Democrats have to be hoping it's anyone but Mitt Romney. He won Utah with 73% of the vote in 2012. He swept every county. He won Salt Lake by a lot. He won Summit County. Any Democrat is going to have a hard time. I do want to say a little part of me wanted Hatch to run so that we could have had sort of that Wikipedia footnote that Hatch ran against Ted Wilson and Jenny Wilson, a father and a daughter.
All right, let me ask you all this finally. I think Thomas Burr, according to political opinion surveys, Utahns might be feeling a little relieved today, have a general affection for the senior senator, but we're thinking it was time for him to go.
Yeah, there's no question. All of the recent Salt Lake Tribune polls and Hinkley Institute, by the way, Morgan, same poll, have shown 75% of Utahns did not want Hatch to run again. However, we have to look at that and say, had Hatch run, he probably would have won. It doesn't, you know, you can look at those polls and say, yeah, but it's a Republican state. He's in the ballot. He would have won.
And it's, I mean, only 22%, 25%, depending on when we were asking the question, of Utahns said they wanted him to run again. But his approvals were much higher. And now that this is off the table, I think his approvals go up and people can focus on his legacy.
David Magleby, take about 30 seconds to respond to this. Are we shifting? Is it a new political era for Utah now with the end of Orrin Hatch politically?
Yeah, when you look at his list of legislative accomplishments, it's hard to imagine a future Utah senator proposing the DREAM Act, being very much proud of the Americans with Disabilities Act, just a name too. And that speaks to the breadth of his legacy. Now, again, he was a very conservative senator, and a lot of liberals don't like him a lot. But he had a remarkable legacy.
David Magleby, professor of political science at Brigham Young University, joined us from KBYU in Provo. Thomas Burr joined us from NPR in Washington. He's the Washington bureau chief for the Salt Lake Tribune. Morgan Lyoncotti, associate director for the Hinckley Institute of Politics. She's with us here in the studio. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.